When assessing America's challenges, Thomas Sowell is one of the thinkers that I turn to first. Economics is his academic discipline. He was a student of the esteemed Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago. Friedman considered Sowell one of his two best students. Sowell entered the University of Chicago as an avowed Marxist, but after a summer internship with the U.S. government, he changed his tune and has remained a staunch defender of the free market for over 60 years. He left teaching and eventually took a position at the Hoover Institute at Stanford, where he has since immersed himself in research and writing. Though an economist by trade, Sowell has branched into several other fields, including politics, social science, and education. Data shapes Sowell's views. He follows the truth where it leads, no matter how controversial. And some of his conclusions make people really uncomfortable. Why is he so controversial? Because Thomas Sowell is a once-in-a-generation mind, a communicator with few peers, and a black man. That last fact should not matter. Thomas Sowell should be evaluated on the basis of his intellectual heft and his impressive academic record and not on the color of his skin. It doesn't matter to me, but it matters to some people. Let me tell you why it matters to them. Sowell specializes in evaluating stories, these stories, Americans tell about social justice issues. Sowell wants to know, do the stories match the facts? Here are just a few examples from his most recent book, published at the end of 2023 when Thomas Sowell was the tender age of 93. The book is titled Social Justice Fallacies. On the notion that the United States is a systemically racist or white supremacist society, Sowell cites a 2019 U.S. Census Bureau survey in which he points out that among full-time, year-round male workers, Asian Indian males earned over $39,000 a year more than white male full-time, year-round workers. White supremacy or systemic racism was our problem in America, Asian males would not be earning exponentially more than white male workers. In American sports, Sowell notes that blacks are very overrepresented in professional basketball, whites in professional tennis, and Hispanics in Major League Baseball. He asks, are Asians kept out of professional basketball? Or are Californians kept out of the National Hockey League? There are more NHL players from Sweden than from California, even though Sweden is on another continent and has about one quarter California's population. This is what makes him so great, because he's brilliant and he's so funny. But these facts do not mean professional sports leagues all engage in racism or other bigotry. Here's one last one. When women are statistically underrepresented in Silicon Valley, some people automatically assume that to be due to sex discrimination by Silicon Valley employers. But it so happens that the work done in Silicon Valley is based on an application of engineering skills, including computer software engineering. And American women receive less than 30% of the degrees in engineering, whether at the college level or the postgraduate level. So Sowell concludes, of course, women are going to be underrepresented in Silicon Valley. As one reviewer of the book put it, Thomas Sowell demolishes the myths that underpin the social justice movement. After I read bits and pieces of this book, one statement stood out to me more than others. Sowell says, and I quote, many assumptions and phrases in the social justice literature are repeated endlessly without any empirical test. Or to put it in my words, the stories we tell ourselves are more powerful than facts and reality. Consider the narrative the children of Israel spin about themselves, about their captivity, about their exodus, and their wandering in the wilderness. Israel's first complaint against Moses blames Moses rather than Pharaoh for their troubles. It begins in Exodus chapter 5, verse 20. Then as Moses and Aaron came out from Pharaoh, the leaders of the children of Israel met Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them, and they said to them, "Let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us." At the beginning of Exodus 5, Moses communicated God's first demand to Pharaoh. Pharaoh responds in two ways. "I don't know Jehovah, so why should I listen to him?" The second thing he says is, "Moses and Aaron, why are you distracting the people from their work?" So Pharaoh ordered the taskmasters to increase the Israelites' workload. And his persecution provoked those complaints from Israel. Now, initially, Moses sided with the people. At the end of Exodus 5, he asked God, "Why did you allow this to happen to them?" And his objection prompts God to offer assurances to Moses and Israel in Exodus chapter 6. But it is at this moment that a narrative begins to develop. A narrative against Moses and Aaron. "It's your fault, Pharaoh, increased our workload, and we'll die because of you." Moses doesn't record any complaints of Israel in chapter 7 through 13 during the plagues. It's easy to understand why. Beginning with plague number 4, God spared Israel by distinguishing Goshen, where Israel lived, from the rest of Egypt. Exodus chapter 8, verse 22. When Moses instructed Israel about the Passover, the people bowed their heads and worshiped. Exodus chapter 12, verse 27. Moses says in the next verse, "Then the children of Israel went away and prepared for the Passover, just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did." There were no complaints. There was only compliance. But as Pharaoh's armies pursued them to the banks of the Red Sea, Israel picks up where it left off back in chapter 5. This is what they say in Exodus chapter 14, beginning in verse 10. "Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt so with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, 'Let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness." Israel blamed Moses. "We told you back in Egypt to leave us alone. We'd rather be slaves in Egypt than free in the wilderness." It's odd that Moses is blamed when he bears so little responsibility for their circumstances. Yes, he confronted Pharaoh. Yes, his rod was used to perform incredible signs and wonders. But who freed Israel from bondage? Who was that? It wasn't Moses, it was God. And while most of the plagues did not affect Israel, surely the destruction and death that they witnessed would have convinced them that the Egyptians posed no threat. But this moment demonstrates the power of narrative. Once it takes hold, a narrative can lead people to deny even what they have seen with their own eyes. And when that narrative feeds on fear, it is nearly impossible to reason with those taken captive. So even though Israel witnessed a series of signs that brought one of the greatest nations in human history to its knees, they clung to their old familiar story. The story rears its head within a month of crossing the Red Sea. In Exodus chapter 16, verses 2 and 3, Moses records the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, and when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into the wilderness, into this wilderness, to kill this whole assembly with hunger." We would have rather died by the hand of the Lord with full bellies. Too many people prefer to be comfortable in slavery rather than face the hardships of liberty. A little over a year later, in Numbers chapter 11, verses 4 through 6, Israel wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we freely ate in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our whole being is dried up. There is nothing at all except this manna before our eyes. Every day it's the same old boring manna. Remember all the variety we had in Egypt? Maybe Egypt wasn't so bad after all." In both of these examples, the children of Israel longed for stability and predictability. They liked the life in Egypt for those reasons. Though they found freedom from slavery in the wilderness, it wasn't the freedom that they either wanted or expected. Freedom took them into the unfamiliar. Freedom meant not knowing what the next day held. Freedom required sacrificing the familiar in the present for something unseen in the future. Freedom meant waiting for what they desired rather than receiving it right now. It's odd to think that a people who cried out for freedom just a couple of years ago would find slavery preferable to anything. But that's Israel's mentality. Thomas Jefferson once remarked, "I prefer the tumult of liberty to the quiet of servitude." Slavery was neat and tidy. Freedom was unsettling and messy. Twice in a year's time, the children of Israel longed for the stability and predictability of Egypt. And when it came time to invade and conquer the land flowing with milk and honey, the children of Israel balked. So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night, and all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, "If only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness. Why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let us select a leader and return to Egypt." Strangely, they preferred death in Egypt or death in the wilderness over death by the sword. It's just another example of Israel wanting to retreat into the familiar and the known. Egypt was predictable. The wilderness had become predictable. Invading Canaan meant going into the unknown. So they narrowed their choices down to two options. Immediate death would be inevitable if they invaded Canaan. But if they returned to Egypt, they'd live a little while and, yeah, they'd die eventually, but eventually, or so they thought, because their reasoning overlooked at least a couple of key facts. Number one, God had provided for their necessities for over a year. How are they going to return to Egypt without his help? He'd helped them all along the way. How are they going to abandon him and make it back to Egypt? That's problem number one. Problem number two, why would Egypt welcome them back with open arms? After their nation was left in ruins, their army wiped out, their wealth depleted, their Pharaoh humiliated, and their deities exposed as frauds. So when the time came to seize what God promised, Israel balked. Why? Because the stories we tell ourselves are more powerful than facts and reality. In their bid for power, in Numbers chapter 16, Korah and his allies used this alternative narrative to their advantage. Korah publicly challenges the authority of Moses and Aaron at the beginning of the chapter. He says in verse 3, "You take too much upon yourselves. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" Israel had long been discontent with the leadership of Moses. When the 40-year-old Moses intervened in a fight between two of his fellow Hebrews, one man said to Moses, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us?" When Pharaoh increased their workload, Israel blamed Moses and Aaron and not Pharaoh. "Why have you, Moses and Aaron, led us out into the wilderness to starve and die?" Miriam and Aaron challenged Moses' authority in Numbers chapter 12. And remember what the children of Israel said when the spies came back from Canaan. "Let us select a leader and return to Egypt." Moses and Aaron had been the targets of Israel's discontent for quite some time. And Korah took full advantage. He accused Moses and Aaron of being ambitious for power, implying that they had become authoritarian. His accusations suggest that Moses and Aaron had taken more than God had given them, thereby exceeding God's ordination. Korah and his allies suggested it was time for new leadership and a fresh direction. This was a public confrontation, and the accusation stemmed from long simmering, widely held frustrations over Moses and Aaron's leadership. But Israel was also discontent with its circumstances. I cited all the passages describing how the hardships in the wilderness frustrated Israel. Later in the 16th chapter of Numbers, Dathan and Abiram voiced those same frustrations in their criticisms of Moses. Notice what they say about Egypt in chapter 16, verse 13. "You have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey." That's a very clever twisting of the facts, isn't it? You led us out of a land flowing with milk and honey, with promises of a land of milk and honey, only to kill us in the barren wilderness. That's what they're saying. Here's just another example of Israel romanticizing its time in Egypt, ignoring the facts and spinning a narrative. Dathan and Abiram go on to accuse Moses of dragging them out to the wilderness to die while he acted like a prince over them. And they accuse Moses of deliberately blinding the people from seeing his actual designs. They ask, "Will you put out the eyes of these men? Are you going to blind them to what you're really after, Moses?" The rich irony is they accuse Moses of gaslighting the people, when in reality, Israel's been gaslighting itself. The congregation conveniently forgot all that God did to break them free from Egypt. They repeated their story to one another so often that it formed an alternative history lacking contradictory facts. And when the time was ripe, those who coveted power used it to their advantage. The frustrations with Moses and Aaron's leadership, the hardships of the wilderness, and the gaslighting about their circumstances in Egypt stirred up deep discontent, thus making Israel ripe for rebellion. Korah attempts to frame this as an us versus them confrontation. Notice in all those examples I cited earlier, Israel complains as a congregation. The children of Israel cried out to the Lord. The whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron. The people complained. The mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving. So the children of Israel wept again and said, over and over, these examples framed the complaints as an airing of the group's grievances. Korah and his allies framed their confrontation as a fight for equality and fairness. For all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. We're all holy, Moses. God is among us all. Why can't we all be priests? Miriam and Aaron tried a similar tactic just a few months before in Numbers chapter 12, verse 2. Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? We are prophets too. Moses isn't special. Korah adapts this tactic in his bid for power. If we're all equal, then Moses and Aaron do not have an exclusive claim to lead the people. Thus, it would only be fair for Moses and Aaron to divest their authority and share it more broadly with the whole congregation. Though it's difficult to know for sure, it does seem that Korah is twisting something that God said earlier in Exodus chapter 19, verses 5 and 6. God says in those two verses, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special people, a special treasure to me above all people. For all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Korah's line, "For all the congregation is holy, every one of them, the Lord is among them," that line, that fits with the notion that Israel is a special treasure and a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. But Korah is distorting the truth to mislead the congregation. God made Israel his special possession. They were his treasure. But God also ordained Moses and Aaron to lead the people. They were not hoarding power to exclude the rest of the congregation from their special relationship with God. They were simply executing what God had called them to do. But again, the facts only matter when they serve the narrative. Korah appears to have distorted God's revelation to stoke that resentment shared by the congregation. His tactic reinforced Israel's perception of itself as an aggrieved community that left the glories of Egypt to follow two proud and selfish men out into the wilderness to die miserable deaths. Korah and his allies also sowed more seeds of doubt about divine guidance. Earlier, I talked about the discontent of Israel. Let's go back to Dathan and Abiram for a moment in Numbers chapter 16, verses 12 through 14, and notice their accusations. "You have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey. You will kill us in the wilderness. You keep acting like a prince over us. You have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey. You have not given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. You intend to blind the congregation to your true intentions." Dathan and Abiram's attacks represent nothing new. If you read all the complaints of Israel, they almost always blame Moses and Aaron and not God for their circumstances. "You have done this, Moses and Aaron." After God punishes the rebels, the next day, the congregation levels a bizarre accusation. Remember, some are swallowed up in the earth. Some are consumed by divine fire. And the next day, the congregation comes to Moses and Aaron, and this is what they say. "You have killed the people of the Lord." Really? Moses and Aaron have killed them? They blame Moses and Aaron for consuming the rebels of Korah with divine fire and opening up the earth to swallow everyone who stood with Dathan and Abiram. Moses and Aaron are blamed, but who's the ultimate target? The ultimate target is God. God promised us a land flowing with milk and honey. God promised us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. But God dragged us out of Egypt into the wilderness to die. The rebels' tactics leveraged the congregation's simmering doubts about God. Korah and those allied with him attempted to manipulate the congregation. These men were driven by ambition for power. Moses calls them out in Numbers chapter 16, verses 8 through 10. Hear now, you sons of Levi. Is it a small thing to you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the work of the tabernacle of the Lord and stand before the congregation to serve them, and that he has brought you near to himself, you and all your brethren, sons of Levi, with you? And are you seeking the priesthood also? God gave the Levites a privileged position. But this group of men was not satisfied. They coveted the priesthood. That's what they were after. And thereby, they coveted the highest positions of power in Israel. But they cloaked their bid for power in a mantle of virtue. They publicly confronted Moses and Aaron, presenting themselves as the champions of the marginalized. The leaders framed the rebellion as a fight for the common good, for justice and equality. We're all holy. God is among us. They tapped into the community's long-held, widely felt sense of grievance. They cleverly deflected blame away from God and placed it squarely on the shoulders of Moses and Aaron. Only Moses saw through their sanctimony and revealed their true intentions. And the danger to Israel was genuine. Moses immediately perceived the danger. Numbers chapter 16, verse 14 says, "So when Moses heard Korah's accusations, he fell on his face." Falling prostrate in response to the confrontation means Moses considered this matter a grave insult to God. God heard the accusations, and he responded decisively. Incinerating the rebels by divine fire and swallowing up the rest of the earth revealed how God viewed this whole episode. Had Moses and God acted more passively, the congregation could have been led astray. Korah and his allies came close to supplanting Moses and Aaron because Israel's attitudes made the congregation ripe for manipulation and rebellion. Why were they nearly successful? Because stories are more powerful than facts and reality. So what should be our takeaways? Israel chose to remember some parts of their history while ignoring others. Sometimes we forget what happened in the past because our minds are actually working correctly. A healthy mind moves memories from short-term to long-term storage. Typically, the negative aspects of our memories are not forgotten, but they fade away into the background. When the mind works correctly, it's the positive aspects of memory that begin to overshadow the negative. That's why everyone thinks the past is much better than the present, because we've forgotten all the negative parts of the past. But nostalgia isn't what's going wrong with Israel. Israel has willfully forgotten significant events in their recent history. They're less than 2 years removed from slavery in Egypt when Korah leads this rebellion. They have deliberately selected to remember some things and forget others. Why? Because the facts do not support what Israel wants to believe about the past. Israel's willingness to exchange reality for a fantasy makes it susceptible to manipulation. George Orwell warned in 1984, that if the powerful can deny, destroy, or debase a people's history, they can control the people. Israel exchanged truth for lies to serve what they thought were their interests. Here's takeaway number two. A victimhood narrative infected Israel. They blamed Moses and Aaron for their hardships rather than Pharaoh. They blamed Moses and Aaron for their plight in the wilderness. They blamed Moses and Aaron for the deaths of the men of Korah and the families of Dathan and Abiram. But there's a noteworthy change to consider for a moment. The final recorded complaint of Israel in the Old Law was punished with fiery serpents. Remember the story? Why is it the last? It's the last because of what's said in Numbers chapter 21, verse 7. Therefore, the people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that he take away the serpents from us." So Moses prayed for the people. Because Israel took full responsibility for their sin, how did God respond? Well, he didn't take away the consequences. They were still getting bitten by snakes. But he provided a way to be saved from death. Why did he do that? Because personal responsibility and accountability are part of God's antidote against the venom of victimhood. Those pursuing power are happy to perpetuate a myth of victimhood if it suits their ends. Takeaway number three. Israel's example shows the dangers of groupthink. Groupthink is a psychological phenomenon in which the group's desires for harmony or conformity result in dysfunctional or irrational decision making. The congregation arrived together at a prevailing point of view of what transpired from Moses' first confrontation with Pharaoh to the spies' return from Canaan. And when God condemned them to wander in the wilderness, what did they do right after that? Well, they decided, let's go take it. And they attacked the Amalekites. They had already defeated the Amalekites in the past. What happened this time? Well, they made a bad decision. And they ended up losing the battle. Groupthink leads to dysfunctional or irrational decision making. Groupthink also discourages dissent. When Moses presented God's side, the congregation just dismissed God's side. It dismissed the facts and his warnings and clung to their narrative. How did the congregation respond to Joshua and Caleb when they countered the other 10 spies? They were ready to stone them with stones. They treated Joshua and Caleb as outsiders and villains. If contrary views are met with threats of execution, then the group is going to naturally engage in self-censorship. No one wants to speak up in a situation like that. Israel attempted to achieve consensus, not by weighing opposing viewpoints, but by pressuring dissenters to conform. But brethren, we reach better conclusions by evaluating several alternatives, weighing one perspective against its counterpoints. As Solomon says, as iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friends. Allowing for respectful dissent and discussion protects us from groupthink and leads to better decisions. But again, the stories we tell ourselves are more powerful and more persuasive than facts and reality. The last takeaway. Israel feared man and not God. What happened when they saw Pharaoh pursuing them to the banks of the Red Sea? They were afraid. Why did they refuse to enter Canaan? They refused because they feared the Anakim and not Elohim. As the second generation of free Israelites prepared to invade Canaan, Moses warned, "If you should say in your heart, 'These nations are greater than I, how can I dispossess them?' You shall not be afraid of them, but you shall remember well what the Lord your God did to Pharaoh and to all Egypt, the great trials which your eyes saw, the signs and the wonders, the mighty hand and the outstretched arm by which the Lord your God brought you out. So shall the Lord your God do to all the peoples of whom you are afraid." Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 17 through 19. This is why the writer of Hebrews reminds us, God himself has said, "I will never leave you nor forsake you." So we may boldly say, "The Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me?" All of this is why Jude warns us about the tactics of false teachers in Jude verse 11. "Woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain, have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah."